This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarterbin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select sort of at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 121st episode of the Quarterbin, we are continuing our little mini-series here for the summer. We are calling it Dial Q for Quarterbin. And for this episode, for part two of this mini-series, we're looking at Adventure Comics 488, featuring Dial H for Hero from DC Comics, cover dated December 1981. If you're not familiar with the concept of Dial H and missed last episode, here's what they say on the first page of this issue. Christopher King, Victoria Grant. When these two ordinary teenagers found the mystic dials, they had no idea that when they dialed the letters H-E-R-O, they would be turned into the greatest superheroes of all time. Now you can join them and help our titanic twosome Dial H for Hero. What they meant by that, by you can join them and help, is that all of the heroes that Chris and Vicky turn into are based on reader submissions of designs and characters. Many, if not all, the villains fit into this, as do many of the outfits and general clothing that the characters wear. Anytime one of those listener-submitted creations appears in the story, that will be pointed out. Think about that. These folks, mostly kids but not always, worked hard on their craft. And the least that we can do here is give them a podcast shout-out merely 37 years later. What I'm going to do with the issues here in Dial Q for Quarterbin is talk about each story with a different guest. That worked for me pretty well in episode 100 last summer, so I figured, why not? Let's try it again here this summer. This issue, Adventure Comics 488, like most of these, has two stories in it. And so this episode, like most of these episodes, will have two guests, one for the first story and one for the second. And that's going to be our plan for the next handful of episodes. And we will get to those guests, those stories, shortly. But first, to use a term coined by Sir Martin of Grey, let's dial F for feedback. On episode 119, I talked about the Marvel Magazine number 2. The great Kenz and Greg Arujo had a few things to say about the Hulk story in that. Excellent episode as usual. Much like you, I wasn't a huge fan of the Hulk, but it was my interest in Burns' work which led me to follow him from Alpha Flight to Hulk. This story does a good job of build-up, but as you continue to read this brief run, you can see that it's building up to something. Between the Hulk fighty fights, you can see Byrne starting to warm up for his eventual Superman run. I thought that was the interesting point there that Greg made, that Hulk was, at least in retrospect, prep for Man of Steel. Greg continues, I suspect Byrne began to feel the same way you do, because he starts experimenting with the way he tells his stories. In the end, I have to give his Hulk run an incomplete, because, well, that's for another day. But as for the pre-Byrne period, it took me a while to appreciate it. I liked that it gave an opportunity to spotlight the second and third tier characters outside the New York area, and sometimes outside the United States. Also, regular doses of the Sal Buscema punch doesn't hurt, as long as you're not receiving them. And I heard from the Twitter feed for acomicbooksite.com, I love the magazines. So many great stories for so little money. So true, so true. Luke Giaconetti of Get Back to the Wrestling and a few other podcasts put in his 2 cents. This magazine sounds like a good deal at the cover price. For 25 cents, it's a legitimate steal. Great mix of Bronze Age reprints. Can't beat it. Agreed, Luke, agreed. Last episode, episode 120, we started this very Dial Q series. In podcasting's, Michael Bailey referred to his appearance as keen. Michael Peacock, also a guest on that episode, commented that at least people can enjoy the Michael Bailey portion and endure my half. Come on, Peacock. It wasn't that bad. Nathaniel Wayne, the chairperson of the Council of Geeks, got a little introspective listening to Bailey talk about the superhero he created as a kid. And Nathaniel floated the crazy idea of us podcasters getting together for a panel or an episode to compare the things we wrote when we were younger. We then talked about all the great ideas we've had for podcast episodes that have never happened and probably never will. Nathaniel added, I always found the concept of Dial H to be very kid-friendly in its possibilities and potential for imaginative content. Extending that out to kids submitting ideas is a fitting one. It's the kind of thing that would have to lean into its own absurdity, and I think extending the design-it-yourself to villains may have been a step too far. I think the randomness of the dial itself lends to childish ideas, but the villains should probably have been kept a little less goofy and a little more menacing to keep this from being a total cartoon of a concept. But sounds like it was still fun. Good listening as always. Geekily yours, Nathaniel Wayne. Now in his email, Nathaniel also proposed what would have been a way better name for this series. Look, Dial Q for Quarterbin's not bad. But his, Dial C for Cheapskate, probably a little bit better. And that was an interesting point that Nathaniel rose, I think, about the villains. And I wonder if they were created by kids as villains, or if just everything that got sent in was eligible for hero or villain status. And if that's the case, would a kid have been disappointed that their hero character ended up as a villain? So I'm not really sure how that worked. Sean Ross, who may potentially, there's a chance that he may be on this very episode. Sean commented on the concept of Spirit Tiger, that one of Chris King's character had part of his shtick. Sadly, I only have a spirit raccoon. He just poops everywhere and fights babies in backyards. Yeah, it's a total bummer, Sean, because as we established last episode, spirit tigers are way cool. Max, who I don't know that we've heard from before, said that he was currently closing in on recollecting a complete run of this iteration of Dial H, so I'm very pleased to find someone podcasting about it. I feel much the same about Avatar as Professor Allen. Great design, cool powers, yeah, a little tough to defend here and now. Do you intend on following this series to its continuation and end in the backup pages of New Adventures of Superboy? First, so glad that you're appreciating the cover, Max, and it's great to hear from you. I do not have specific plans to do that, although there is one particular issue of Superboy that I have my eyes out for in Quarterbins, and if I find it, definitely would cover that. But beyond that, I mean, we may get some more Dial Q after this series, but if so, it's probably going to be a while. In addition to naming this segment Dial F for feedback, Sir Martin of Grey also had some interesting things to say about our first Dial H episode. Great episode. I was buying these issues as they came out, and they were great fun. It felt like a big deal having Marv Wolfman write some of these. And while Infantino wasn't at his peak, I still liked his crisp layouts. And at least he'd gotten over the Spider-Woman bullet boobs by then. In terms of the cultural appropriation, Sir Martin says, it's just a turban. People should just relax. It's a nice comics tradition that says, hey, we like your cultural, religious style. So long as there's no mocking, what's the problem? Should there be protests outside Sunset Boulevard performances because Norma Desmond rocks a turban? I'm Roman Catholic and managed to survive seeing rosary beads used as fashion. My friend Will, designed a couch that appeared in Dial H for Hero, though he was going by his birth name back then. I fully expect that settee to get its own movie any time now. Sir Martin added, I like Michael Bailey's idea of a letter hacks show. I wasn't in U.S. comics much, but had loads in U.K. stuff. Marvel's Next Wave trade, unusually, includes the letter columns, so I'm immortalized. Ish. And good on Mike Peacock. Love that chap's voice. One of the best in podcasting. So cheery. Also, I appreciate him for speaking up for the art of Dashing Don Heck. Now, Mike Peacock replied to this comment on his smooth vocal stylings with, on my business card, I should add, when you need an adult podcaster to sound like a preteen, call me. Sir Martin also asked a question about my description of Batman and Superman as anger characters in Detective and Action. Of course, I had tried to say anchor at that point, as in those characters anchoring or holding down those books. Sir Martin and I agreed to blame Skype, my recording software, and my darned American accent for the confusion. Those episodes received social media love from the people mentioned above and Robert Ludwig, Gene Hendricks of 22 Freaks, J. Jones Goldstein of comics.blog, Paul Matthew Carr of the Collected Edition, Bill Baer, Old School Ross, Scott X, Mr. Dystopia, Sean Ross from Secret Wars and Beyond, Connell, Karen from the very sweet Between the Pages blog, Jeffrey Brown, writer of the Valkyrie Quartet comic, Dr. Ange, the Checkered Past podcast, Ted Kilvington from Justice Trek, Professor Frenzy, the great Kans and Gregorujo, Al Sedano, the Nexus of All Realities, Andrew at All-Star DC Comics, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, and Laurel, a.k.a. Mountain Flower One. Thanks for everybody for their support. So let's take a break here, play a promo, and then me and a special guest whose identity I may have already spoiled, we'll be back to talk about the lead story in Adventure Comics 488.
Guys, we finally developed our time machine. Should we use it to go back and see how Stonehenge was built?
Or become friends with Hitler and convince him to stay in art school?
Or we could go back in time and get the comic books we missed.
Yeah!
The Comic Book Time Machine. A journey back in time to explore comic books. Good and bad. Whether from 7 decades ago or 7 days ago. Join our journey at comicbooktimemachine.com.
And we're back. And to kick off this second episode of Dial Q for Quarterbin, we are dialing up a relatively geeky rookie, making his first appearance on the network all the way from Astro City. It's Sean Ross.
Hey, thanks for having me. Long-time caller, first-time listener. Is that how it goes?
Welcome to the Quarterbin, buddy. It's good to meet you.
It's good to meet you as well. I'm super excited to be part of the show, and I'm happy that my stalking you for, I think, a good 8 months worked. I'm glad I finally wore you down, and you were like, you know what? I'm just going to have you on because I cannot deal with you anymore. So I'm glad to be here.
Well, we are looking at Adventure Comics 488, cover dated December 1981, had an original cover price of 60 cents, meaning I got this at a mediocre, 59% markdown off that original price. The cover by Ross Andrew and Dick Giordano shows a photographic darkroom with photographs hanging on clips as part of the photo development process. If you're under the age of 35 or don't otherwise know what we mean by developing photos, I mean, keep listening to the episode, that's fine, but just get off my lawn. We also have a pair of gloved hands holding a photo of our heroes in mid-transition, and we hear the ominous dialogue. Now that I've learned the true identities of these superheroes, I will destroy them. Pretty dramatic, huh? What do you think?
you heard the ominous dialogue. I heard the theme song from To Catch a Predator, because effectively this man is holding pictures of two teenagers in the photo dark room. So this went a very different direction for me when I first looked at it. I suddenly flashed back to the many, many times the kids from Different Strokes were kidnapped in the 80s. And I was like, oh my God, I'm having PTSD from the Reagan era kidnapping sitcoms. Yeah, so
I think there's a reason he's developing these photos himself. Because the Kodak booth on the corner would have to call the police. How many different 11 and 12-year-olds have you photographed here?
Yeah, he's like, okay, Mapplethorpe, thanks for the film, but we're going to move on. I love this cover. It's super busy. I think there are too many images on it to sell well, but I absolutely love the use of pink. I think it's unusual in comics, and I think it really – it adds a dramatic flair to the cover. So I love the color. My compliments to the colorist. I think the composition's a little busy, but it's a nice cover.
I'm glad they found a few plot points to sort of hang just a little bit of continuity on. And this legitimate question of how does one town have so many one-time pairs of superheroes? Someone would notice.
Look, the Jinx, who we will meet in a minute, is no Batman. He's not the world's greatest detective, but... he's able to string those breadcrumbs together pretty effectively. And the comic You Create font reminds me of the font they use on the cover of Ambush Bug comics, so I would have bought it
hilarious.
For that.
That's hilarious. They talked about this in the last episode, but a huge disadvantage in putting together a cover here because you can't put on, I don't know, a character we've ever heard of.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're severely limited in what you can do with the covers to make them attractive.
It's a challenge, which I think is why we get... You know, one of the dominant images is the character we'll meet soon, Ragnarok. And I think, you know, that's similar enough to maybe some other characters that we know from comics that might draw some people in. And there are allusions and there are copyright infringement. And Ragnarok just rubs right up against that.
Well, our story is Jay, as in Jinx, and Jeopardy. Written by the Answer Man himself, Bob Rozakis, with art by Carman Infantino and Dennis Jensen. A brief synopsis here. We meet the villain, the Jinx, created by Larry King, age 19, Mooresville, Vermont. Not the Larry King from TV interviewing fame, because in 1981, that Larry King was 104 years old. Not 19. So the Jinx has figured out that the odds of the city of Fairfax having so many different heroes is astronomical and figures that they must be the same people making multiple transitions. And for a bad guy, there's some perception there. So the Jinx goes to a museum where an atomic sub is docked, and Fairfax Middle School, at least a science class, is there on a field trip, and everyone is surprised when the electrical crab man appears. This is Heavy Sigh, Cancero, credited by Michael Clark, age 16, Cincinnati, Ohio, but he is faced down by Oxide, credited by David Mark, age 13, from Agincourt, Ontario, and the Harp, credited by Darren Gooden, also age 13, from Houston, Texas. And despite their bad luck, which they get courtesy of the Jinx, because that's his power, if that wasn't clear, our team succeeds. And at this point, my plan of mentioning all the creators and their ages and where they came from seemed like a great idea until we get to this story. And you, Mr. Sean, you get more of these to decide from than anyone, I think.
I have the poo-poo platter. You hit the jackpot. No. I do. I definitely have the poo-poo platter of Dial H characters. And poo might be the right word for some of them.
Hey now. Now, later, a bank is robbed by Jelly Woman. You did not mishear that. Credited by Lincoln Wirt, age 12, parts unknown. But Ragnarok, the Cosmic Viking, created by Nelson Jimenez, age 18, Stamford, Connecticut, and the Pixie, created by Bill Cunningham, age 18, Aiken, South Carolina, are able to contain her. But the police don't like their fighting strategies. And if the officers can't recognize their inherent goodness, they aren't going to talk to them. But the Jinx has noted that Chris and Vicky appeared at both of these occurrences, figures that they're the heroes and wants to eliminate them. Busted. Then some bad luck puts them in the Jinx's vicinity and they dial themselves up Captain Saturn, created by Terry Powell, age 24, Muskego, Wisconsin, and Snowfall, created by Christopher Benjamin, age 13, Winslow, Arkansas. So close to thinking that would be Winslow, Arizona.
Me too.
One of your people, but... I mean, I'm not going to judge the people whose submissions have made it in to these first couple of episodes, but mostly it seems to be people from the Midwest and the upper parts of the country, you know, where they have 5 months inside for winter with nothing to do but create comic book characters. Well... You know, you Arizonans might have a little thing called the sun.
Yeah, yeah. I kept expecting to see created by Joel and Ethan Cohen in the credits because there's some doozies in here.
They figure out that if they do the opposite of what they want, see, opposite because of the bad luck, it will work in their favor and become good luck, which works, and the bad guy is taken away. But one lingering plot point, he still knows who they are, right?
Mm-hmm.
The end. I'm glad they didn't go the traditional comic book route, which is as soon as you discover somebody's secret identity, your death count starts pretty quickly. You've got maybe 2.5 pages before you're dead.
Well, I was expecting the Mind Eraser created by someone, you know,
exactly,
from Oshkosh, Wisconsin or something.
Created by Charles Xavier of what? Wait a minute. Brad Meltzer? Huh? Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, the No Moral Boundaries Man created by Brad Meltzer. That was one of my favorites.
I'm just asking sort of where this fits. If you had to put this comic somewhere between, say, Secret Wars Volume 2, Issue 4, on one end of the spectrum, and the Confessor arc of Astro City on the other?
Because
I think like every comic fits somewhere in between those two.
That is a good spectrum.
Overall, big picture thoughts.
Wow. So this could have been a subplot for Secret Wars 2. It is of that quality. It is. I really think Bob Rozakis got a question sent to the answer man that said, hey, what issue has the most heroes and villains per panel? And he was like, I don't know the answer, so I'm just going to write Adventure Comics number 488.
I'm going to be the answer. I'm going to be the answer. Now, I do like the idea that their identities are known. That's been teased at a little bit in some prior issues. And it is weird that it was unfulfilled, but I'm glad they addressed that. Guys, like I said, a lot of comics make some big leaps about secret identities, and you have to buy in to what might be an unbelievable premise. So I like that here they're saying, no, someone could figure out who they are.
It is definitely the most intriguing plot point in this comic, and I do like the fact – I mean, the fact that the Jinx figures it out is compelling and interesting. The fact that it is so easy for him to figure out kind of terrifies me for Chris King and for Vicky, because I think we are going to get some, you know, dark examinations of this series in the future from DC, where we realize that Dial H was not as innocent as we always thought.
Well, spoilers for the next part of this very episode. Chris's father, Detective King, has some thoughts. That's all I can say. I mean, we did joke about it, but I do like the multiple characters. I mean, that is the shtick of the story. And if you have one where they change ones, it's like, you kind of feel let down. It's like, you know, the Hulk out. Mm-hmm. You need to have that happen at least twice. You can't just have it once. You're missing something.
Well, and I liked that there were multiple changes. I felt a little bit like this series was, I mean, I think the Dial H, it only lasts in Adventure Comics, what, like 3 more months or a few more months? It's not much longer.
Yeah, we're getting towards the end.
Yeah, and so I thought, okay, Rozakis is just dumping out the junk drawer. Like, he is like, okay, I've got all these kids from around the country who have sent in characters. Let's just use as many of them as we can in this issue. And so I did like the multiple changes, and I know in a minute we'll talk about maybe who our favorites are, but, I mean, there's decompression, and then there's, like, this is, like, explosive decompression. I don't know. I don't even know what the opposite is. I need a science teacher for this, but this is it's so frequent. The changes are frequent and the crimes are so frequent that apparently Fairfax is like the murder capital of the world or something, because there is a crime every block. It's pretty shocking.
Ever have any experience taking any of your kids on student field trips to atomic sub plants?
Yeah, exactly. What museum has an atomic sub? This is, in what world is this occurring? And I do want to point out, because there's a nice moment where the, you know, Brad, which is, he might as well be played by Billy Zabka. Like, he is clearly, it's clearly a jerk. And he's about to trip Chris as they're walking across a, you know, and even in the comic, it's clearly a very rickety and rusted out platform above water. And he's trying to trip him. And the Jinx sees this, and from his sort of hiding place, he jinxes Brad and makes him fall. And I was like, oh, okay, maybe Jinx is a good dude after all. And so I don't know, I wanted more of that. I wanted a little bit more of his backstory.
And then we get Cancero.
Oh.
Quite a panoply. How about that, Mr. English teacher? A panoply of characters created here. Now, earlier in this episode, in the feedback section, Nathaniel Wayne asked sort of about the difference between the villains that were created and the heroes that were created. And I'm curious, did people just send in the Jinx or send in Cancero just as general characters? Or were they, I mean, did they send them in to be villains? So, I mean, if you had created the Jinx thinking this was going to be, you know, the next big hero, and you open up the book and it's a villain, are you disappointed?
I think that's a really valid question, because I do wonder, there are a couple of them. Like, for example, Chris turns into Oxide, who has the power to make things rust. Yeah. That's awesome. That is that's the superhero find of 1981. and so Oxide, I will tell you, the minute I saw his costume, and this is just a trope of costumes at this time period, but usually that full facial mask that even goes into the lips, the sort of Mr. Miracle or Parasite effect, those are usually villains, yeah. Or at least at this time they were. So I do wonder about that. And then looking at the harp, I mean, she looks like, you know, Betty or Ross, who turns into the Harpy in Marvel Comics. And so she looks like a villain as well. And I was like, you know, poor Cancero or Cancer, you know.
He had no chance.
Oh my God, he's just trying to be an electrical crab in the world, man. That's hard enough. I definitely do think people just sent, or, you know, especially the kids, just sent in character designs or character descriptions. Right. And then Rosakis was like, oh, okay, you know, you're in the bad pile, you're in the good pile. Let's make a story about that.
Now, Bob Rosakis was one of the names that I knew from reading comics in the late 70s from that Answer Man column. So I can see the fun of him doing this story. He's not going to write the next great Eisner Award-winning story.
No.
But I kind of think his skill set did kind of fit here.
I have some major questions. I have questions. And the Jinx's overall plan seems a little like, I don't know, Baron Zemo from Captain America Civil War. Like it's so labyrinthine that I can't even... The guy has enough money to hire Cancero and the aptly named Jelly Woman, whom a lot of people don't know was the fourth member of Destiny's Child. He has enough money for this, and yet his grand scheme is to get these heroes out of the way so he can rob an armored car in the middle of the day on the local bike path. I did not understand why he needed quite the level of planning and detail for what is effectively a knockoff job from a Hostess cupcake ad. Like, I just don't. I was really struggling with it.
You also do get the feeling that maybe these Dial H stories were farmed out in, it's a Friday afternoon, we need a story by Monday. Can you knock that out for us, Bob? Or Miscellaneous, whoever else writes the stories? You know.
Yeah, the plot is thin, but there's some campy fun here. Some of the characters are very interesting. I wonder about Jelly Woman, who is literally just a creature made of jelly. I mean, she looks like a failed sculpture model for the first line of Gumby toys. Like, I mean, even just the way Infantino draws her, she's consistently missing an arm. Like, I don't understand how her appendages work, and I don't really understand really just anything about her.
If your body was made of jelly, would your appendages work?
it's so interesting because the way he draws her. So at one point, she's moving in to attack Ragnarok. And she's missing an arm. She kind of looks like the Venus de Milo. And then there's a when the pixie encases her in a magic dust field, I guess, she again looks like something from the Louvre. So I don't know if Infantino – I don't know. I honestly think Carmine Infantino – how do I put this delicately? I think this is might be his FUDC, I used to be Carmine Infantino comic. Like, I think – I mean, he was a big deal in the, you know, 60s and 70s, which is not something I learned until much later in my collecting career. Even for Infantino, I mean, the art in this is – there are some panels, Jelly Woman in particular, where I'm like, oh, Carmine, you were really dealing with some issues here. You were processing the way DC was treating you, and I feel for you.
Now, we don't have anything as fancy over here as – Secret Shame Awards, or what's the Beyonder bonus? What?
We have the Booyahs from Beyond, and then this, our Secret Shame Award on our Secret Earth podcast.
We have our 9 characters here, so I put you to work, buddy. That's all I'm saying.
You really did.
So, just favorite name of a character. We have a lot to choose from, so can we just by acclamation eliminate Kinsiro from consideration?
It's
the worst name for anything ever.
Yeah, but I think we're selling him short because he is not just Kinsiro. He is Kinsiro, the electrical crab man. And that's not helping. So I'm an English teacher. This is how big a nerd I am. As I was doing my research for this episode, and by the way, I think I did more research than Rosakis did in writing the book. I took more time and was more methodical. I was like, what is the connection between crabs and electricity? Like, what am I missing? And I went into a deep dive into the world of crabs, and I could not find a connection between crabs and electricity. So I don't know, man. I think Michael Clark of Cincinnati, Ohio, you just mailed it in, buddy. Like, if you're going to take the time to create a character for Dial H, like,
it could have at least been half crab, half eel hybrid. That's all we're asking.
I want to shame some of these kids. Like, I actually want to find Michael Clark and you know, the grown version of him on Facebook and be like, hey, did you create Kinsiro? Yeah. And then just be like, what were you thinking? Like, what did you do with your life, Michael Clark? So to answer the original question, I will say my favorite name.
You have enough to choose from. You can have some honorable mentions.
So my favorite name is definitely Ragnarok, the Cosmic Viking.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah, I mean, there's no argument about that.
Yeah.
There's some other pretty good ones, though. What else did you like?
So that was my favorite Chris name. I definitely not liked Snowfall for Vicky. I thought that was a really lovely name. And then for villain, I mean, it's got to be the Jinx, only by elimination, because Jelly Woman just doesn't strike fear into the hearts of men.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Pixie and Captain Saturn, I mean, they're sort of generic enough. Oxide is different. Snowfall is pretty good, but yes, it has to be Ragnarok. How about costumes? Now, I'm a big fan of the underrated Superman villain who you mentioned, the Parasite.
Mm-hmm.
So I like Oxide because there's some pretty clear similarities. You know, purple bodysuit, basically.
I think Oxide deserves honorable mention just for having a green codpiece, because codpiece fashion has come a long way since Hamlet. But I was really pleased. I was like, wow, Infantino, extra time and attention. I would say my favorite. I gotta say, one of my standards for costumes in a comic book is would I put it on the side of my van in 1976? And Ragnarok the Cosmic Viking would absolutely be there. So he's winning the round here. He's best costume for me too.
Captain Saturn had some cool rings. They make no sense,
but at
I thought
all.
They kind of looked good. Kind of like the Pixie. I think I might go with the Pixie. It's predictable, but I think the shades of green, that sort of, I'm a sucker for that sort of Robin Hood style hat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, perched at an angle. So what can I say? I'm gonna have to go with the Pixie on this one.
That was my second choice, and I actually, as much as I'm kind of bag on Infantino for his art in this book, the panel where she names herself, and then the one right after where she's sort of dispensing her dust, that's a really nice panel. I mean, it looks very, you know, I mean, obviously this character is an homage to Peter Pan and Tinkerbell, and he really captures it in that panel. So it is a nice costume and name.
And again, at least to the extent that we can figure it out, favorite power set. again, to simplify, we can eliminate Jelly Woman, right?
Just
between us.
I think she is a grape flavored Clayface. Like I don't know that I would eliminate her so quickly.
All right, well, you get the first call then.
Again, Ragnarok is really good. I'm going to go with Pixie though. I liked the idea of. It took me a second to figure out. Well, what are her powers here? And I was like, okay, she's kind of a modified Sandman. Like, you know, she's got this magic dust and she can do things with it and create shapes. And I was like, that's a pretty cool power. And plus she can shrink and fly. So Pixie was my choice.
Always been a sucker for music-based powers. So the harp ended up pretty high on my list. But you've mentioned this one before. I don't even know what a cosmic Viking is, but it sounds awesome.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds powerful. Hello, Ragnarok. Congratulations go to Nelson Jimenez, age 18, Stamford, Connecticut, for, I think, creating the clear winner among all categories combined.
We have to pour one out for Nelson because he was from Stamford, so he died in the first issue of Civil War. I was pretty saddened by that. Yeah, I saw that. And I was like, oh, Speedball killed you, Nelson. I'm really sorry about that.
He's a Nordic character, but they're in the public domain.
Mm-hmm.
They've existed for thousands of years, so it's a little bit Thor, a little bit Odin in terms of the look, or a little Hagar the Horrible, or
there is a little bit of that. Yeah, I liked it a lot, and look, the addition of cosmic to the description,
that's what sold it for me.
Absolutely piqued my interest. I was like, oh my god, I would read an entire book about Ragnarok the Cosmic Viking, and you know, it comes with its own, you know, Led Zeppelin 4 soundtrack. You know, I in a book filled with derivative characters, I mean, Rob Liefeld would read this and be like, dude, get your own ideas. Like, but you know what? Sometimes imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, and I am all about Ragnarok. I liked him a lot. I thought it was a great character.
Any other thoughts on the story or on the issue?
Yeah, I have real issues with the way they depict middle school students.
What experience do you have with this?
Okay, so I speak from experience. I was a classroom teacher for 15 years, and a chunk of that was spent in middle school. I mean, I've literally taught in a classroom where when people walk in and say, "What color's on the walls?" I say, "Puberty." Like, I've earned my stripes. You know, and I like to refer to any school system crazy enough to put an entire school of 7th and 8th graders together. Like, every one of those should be called Petri Dish Junior High. Like, it's just – it's not good. So I've taught middle school, so I know these kids and I know this brain. And I will tell you, and you know this, you are what you teach. So when I taught middle school, I was absolutely a grown man who, when somebody would say something about, you know, like a wiener dog, I would giggle. Like, you become a middle school student. So I'm reading this book and I'm like, okay, Chris and Vicky are in middle school. They find this dial, and if you dial H-E-R-O, you know, dial H, you turn into a hero. Within 0.4 seconds of discovering that dialing H turns you into a hero, they absolutely would have dialed B for butt or B for boobs. And they would have seen what different combinations they could have created. And we would have been treated to, like, Captain Anus and the Areola, like the great comic characters of 1981. Like, I have real issues because I know the middle school brain, and they absolutely would have been putting dirty words into the H dial and seeing what came out. So I
thought your concern was going to be, well, you know, when they appear in their costumes, they appear to be aged, they're more muscular, she's more developed sometimes. I thought you were going with a real problematic area.
No, just going historical
inaccuracy.
Pin back the first time you held a Casio calculator in your hands and somebody put 80085 into it and then showed it to you. And that's middle school. Like, that's pure distilled middle school. And I was really offended at how boring and clean cut Vicky and Chris are. Like, they're not real. They're not middle school kids. Yeah, I had real issues with it, man. I struggled with the depiction of these kids. I didn't buy it. So I and also, you know, on a more serious note, I would have liked to have just gotten to know them a little bit better.
That
I didn't necessarily
slow burn. By the time we're recording this, the first episode is out, and you heard, you know, Brad was in the prior episode. So there is a little weird sort of love triangle, you know, at that level. You know, there's some crushes and there's a little bit of bullying. So I think some of that adds an essence of real life, though, as you've pointed out, they're missing the key distinctive of middle schoolers.
I wanted to know them a little bit better. I also kind of wanted to know what motivated them. Like, okay, you do, like, you know, and look, I'm not going to take this super seriously. This is supposed to be a fun, goofy book, but I need a little motivation. Like, why are you becoming heroes? You know, why is there so much crime in Fairfax? Like, you know, a little backstory would have gone a long
way. That second
one
I don't know is ever answered.
Yeah. I could have done without Jelly Woman. I could have done it without one of the layers of villains, yeah, just for a little bit more character and backstory. Mm. I was collecting comics by this point. This is actually exactly when I started collecting. Okay. And I went to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, you know, in preparation for this episode. And I was like, okay, what else was on the stands when this came out? I want to see what I was buying in, because I didn't buy this. And I want to know why, because I was kind of one of those spinner rack kids who I was like, oh, okay, I'll take this. I'll take this, whatever happened to be out. And at this point,
I assume you just said 60 cents. That's too expensive for anything.
No, I was a 60-cent kid. I liked when they went to 60 and I
with
could
the
easily
tax,
do the addition.
Three for $2, basically.
Well, actually, I lived in Oregon at the time. So yeah, none of this sort of kleptocracy sales tax stuff that we have in the rest of the country. So I only had to add by sixes. So it was really easy to be a comic book collector. I was like, hey, 5 comics for $3. There you go. You know, Claremont's X-Men's happening and Roger Stern's on Spider-Man and the Elektra saga's happening in Daredevil and even Wolfman and Perez are on Teen Titans. And I just feel like it's funny. I because I was really asking myself, why didn't I buy this book at the time? I'm sure I saw it. Why didn't I buy it? And I think even at a very, very, very young age, this just felt a little too dated for me.
Yeah, it is. We could say by young people for young people.
And I like it now. I definitely, as I'm getting older and I'm, you know, firmly getting, I'd LASIK the other day to put nostalgia goggles permanently on my eyes. And now that I can actually, you know, now that I'm looking back with a sort of sweetness, a bittersweetness to this era, I, you know, I love these issues. I love the campy fun of them. But I can see why as a kid, I was like, no, I really actually didn't get into DC Comics until post-crisis.
Yeah. This is what, 81, 82? I've read a few from 83, 84, not of Adventure, but other DC books. And you could see they needed to change.
Yeah.
You know, this was on the young end of what they were doing, the silly end of what they were doing, but it did sort of fit in. You know what I mean? Especially compared to Marvel. New Teen Titans is the one that stands out as being really different.
Well, it's interesting because Marv Wolfman even says they brought him over to Marvel, you know, Marvelized DC. The thing that struck me about this issue is this comic book could have come out in any of the 3 decades prior to its release. And it would have made...
Wow, right.
Yeah, would have made sense. Would have been the same comic, but... I like it. And now I enjoy it. It's quaint. I guess that you were saying, you know, any other comments on the issue? I have a question for you. So Greg Arujo and I host Marvel Secret Wars podcast on the Pulp to Pixel podcast network. And we always bring...
You're blaming the great Kansan for this question. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I am. I am. I like to call him Kansas City Arujo. So, so we do something on our show to kind of keep each other on our feet. We always bring in secret questions, like questions for the person that they didn't prepare for, to kind of see if we can, you know, see what they think and catch them a little off guard.
All right. Note to self, cut this part out of the episode.
You're like, Sean, it was so nice having you on this one episode, and you'll never, ever pollute our airways again. So I have a secret question for you. How do you feel about the adults who are submitting character designs and character names? Like one of the characters, Captain Saturn was created by Terry Pavlett, and he's 24 years old. How do you feel about adults creating characters for Dial H?
Well, just last issue, we had a clothing design from 30-year-old Cat Ironwood, just on the verge of a career in comics. So maybe Terry Pavlett, age 24, from Wisconsin, actually turned out to be... I'm trying to think of someone who would be the appropriate age. Bill Willingham. Maybe it's a pen name of some... No. You know, young adult, I think if you were doing this in your teens, you might still be doing it in your 20s. Although filling out the form and submitting, that would be the bridge too far for me.
Yeah, I... 24... I was okay with... the 18-year-olds, and I was, and actually, I like that you bring up D&D character creation, because that my mind kind of went there too. Like, oh, it's still fun to participate in that process. I was married by 24, and the idea of telling my wife, "Hey, can I have a stamp so I can mail this Captain Saturn drawing into DC Comics to see if I can get into a comic book aimed at 9-year-olds, I think that might have been an issue for me. Yeah, I don't know. I struggle.
But you could spin it this way. Adjust the dollar amounts to today. Honey, 50 cents for a stamp. But if I make it in, I get a free T-shirt that's worth $14.
That is true.
So it's like, to me, it's sort of a money-making opportunity.
I actually saw Terry Pavlett at a Comic-Con, and I had him sign my issue of Adventure 488. It was interesting. I do have to say, too, Captain Saturn, I was a little disappointed, because if Terry had created, say, Ragnarok, I would have been like, okay, cool. There's a little edge to that. Captain Saturn, if you're above 13 and you're creating Captain Saturn, then I think you need to question your life choices.
I hope someone tags him on Twitter for this conversation. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and assume his kid brother was reading the book and he pulled out the design that of Captain Saturn that he created when he was 12 and sent it in. That's my story for Dr. Pavlett.
He's now doctor. That's awesome. For Senator Pavlett from the great state of Wisconsin. This was a fun issue. I liked it. I definitely got more bang for my buck. I got a lot of characters to look into, so I appreciated that. And it's a scope, like you said, we get cosmic Vikings all the way to Jelly Woman. It was an interesting
and
range.
Everything in between.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a range.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed yourself. Thank you so much for joining us, Sean. It was great having you here. And if anyone wanted to dial up your podcasts, which, by the way, you've done a remarkable job promoting during the course of this conversation. First of all, where would you send people to find your other podcasting work?
I appreciate the acknowledgement. Even as I was slipping those references in, I was like, man, I'm a marketing
genius.
I'm like the guy at the end of the Micro Machines commercial. Like, I'm just dropping in those quick references. I co-host Marvel Superheroes Secret Wars and Beyond. It's a podcast with Greg Arujo where we review every issue of the Marvel Superheroes Secret Wars miniseries. We finished Volume 1, the much beloved first series from 1984. And we are now halfway through Volume 2, the less beloved miniseries from 1985.
And the two of you have had things to say about it.
Yeah, we are literally chronicling Jim Shooter's midlife crisis. It is
descent into madness, one could say.
It's a drive down the jungles into darkness, and Greg. Like, thankfully, Greg is with me, and so we are going insane together. We're on the Pulp to Pixel podcast network. We also have a show that you referenced called Welcome to Astro City, in which we review each issue of Kurt Busiek and Brent Anderson's amazing Astro City book. Which sadly has ended in monthly format, but they're going to sort of a graphic novel structure, which is great. And you can find me there, and guest hosting on this show for one time. If you enjoy it, because I don't think I'm ever going to be invited back.
that was Kurt Busiek. I believe he changed his name from Terry Pavlett at one point. I'm almost certain of that. I'm not pretty sure of that. If you go back in the records again, thank you.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
We're going to take a break here, and we come back. It's another guest and the second story from this issue.
The Modern Life Podcast Network focuses on technology, lifestyle, business, sports, and culture. Our modern lives can be hectic, demanding one day and relaxing the next. Our hosts discuss the issues facing our modern lives and provide the answers and ideas to make the journey through life and business a bit easier. Find your new favorite podcast at modernlifepodcastnetwork.com. Modern issues, modern discussions.
And we're back with longtime supporter of the network, good friend of Relatively Geeky, and a person that I've just recently met IRL. It's Luke Giaconetti.
I'm still impressed that even after we met in real life, you let me back on the show. That's the thing that really staggers me.
After meeting you in real life, hanging out with you for a while, I realized you are a great Skype friend.
Hey, I've often been told that, you know, radio might be a stretch, but I have a great face for podcasting, so.
Well, welcome back to the Quarterbin.
Well, thank you. It's always great to be back on the Quarterbin Podcast here on the relatively geeky podcast network.
So what is your history with comics from the early 80s in general or Dial H in particular, if any?
Being born in 1980, most of my contemporary experience with comics from the early 80s revolves mostly around Richie Rich, favorite here on the network, Richie Rich.
Absolutely.
Because I didn't start reading comics for real, air quotes up to the mic, until the very early 90s with Marvel's Toxic Avenger. But I did read a lot of 80s comics as a kid, because once I got into comics, one of the first superhero books I used to buy off of the spinner rack at the 7-Eleven right across the state line in Danbury, Connecticut. I think that 7-Eleven is still there, actually. At least it was the last time I was in Danbury, which was a couple of years ago. I used to buy the second series of The Silver Surfer. There's a big flea market up in Stormville, New York. It's usually only on like holiday weekends. And I'd always go back issue hunting then when I was maybe about 10, 11. I bought a bunch of those early Silver Surfers with the Elders of the Universe and the Fantastic Four in there a little bit. And I didn't get into comics more so into the 90s, as I said. So my experience with the 80s stuff is all back issues.
So obviously a little too young to submit to Dial H here in 1981, 82. But let me ask it this way. Would you have been the type of person to submit a character design? Is that what you're doing? I know your brother has some artistic interests. Do you share any of that? Did you design and doodle and sketch comic characters?
I think every comic book reader worth their salt at some point had a notebook in the back that, instead of paying attention in English class or whatever, had a whole pantheon of characters. And I did have some of those. Actually, it's one of the characters in this book does a power trick, which is, I want to say when I was in college, it was whatever the current edition is of Mutants and Masterminds, which is a D20 based superhero role playing game. And I created a character for a session that I never got to play that exhibits a power exhibited by one of the characters here.
Spoilers.
But no, I did have my pantheon of characters. I'm unfortunately not the most creative person when it comes to this kind of stuff. I tend to be, unfortunately, wear my derivative influences on my sleeve with some of this stuff. So I don't know that I would have, but I bet you if I was reading this, I would have thought, yeah, I can do that. Yes, I can do this. And then I would have, attempted it and given up.
Which I'm sure was part of the ploy. To get kids to look and say, I could do better than that. I'll submit.
As for Dial H itself, the only Dial H I've ever read is I did read, there was a very short-lived New 52 version of Dial H.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which dropped the four heroes, just called Dial H. And that Dial H was, it was almost like a, I'm trying to think of it, I believe it was New 52, but it was almost like a Vertigo book. It was like a horror sort of angle to it, where you never knew what was going to be dialed up, just like it is in the traditional Dial H. But it was some awful things that they dialed up sometimes. I'm trying to remember if that was New 52 or if that was like a late Vertigo.
Yeah.
I don't have it in front of me, but I read a few issues of that. And then, the realities of, wow, you're buying a lot of comics. So you got to cut some of these back. Start setting in.
I hear you. But I like that taking their inspiration from the Harry Potter jelly beans, any flavor jelly beans you dial up, you never know what kind of character you're going to get. I kind of like that.
Right.
That's an idea.
That to me has always been kind of the appealing thing of Dial H, is this concept of, again, it's like you're sitting around rolling up characters for a role-playing game. Mm-hmm. You're not sure what you're going to end up with once you start, but based on what you have, you got to figure something out. And there's a certain creative aspect that not every character is going to have a power set that's useful for the given situation. So there's a bit of a creative angle of, okay, I'm falling from an airplane and I've got somebody that can fold paper into really sharp points. How do I, how do I use this to my advantage?
Spoilers for Origami Man coming up in the next issue.
Yeah.
Now, we've already looked at our cover, so let's just jump into the story. We've got the backup story here, which is Tender Poison, written by George Kasdan with art by Trevor Von Eden and Larry Malstedt, and a brief synopsis of this kind of brief story. On a field trip to a biochem lab, a Hamilton Junior High science class meets a woman named Angela, but she is no longer Angela. She is Belladonna, Princess of Potions, created by Susan Kijamakez, age 23, Boston, Mass. Christopher King manages to sneak off and turn himself into Moonlight, created by Vincent Broese, age 14, Whittier, California. They have a pretty decent fight, but Belladonna eventually knocks him out with an elixir. He is awakened shortly thereafter by his father, Detective King. Moonlight stumbles out, leaving the detective to wonder how this new hero knew his name. He finds Vicky, and she helps him walk off the effects of Belladonna's darts. And when his dad arrives home, he is still a little woozy, and his dad is a little suspicious. But before he can give it more thought, Detective King is called to another scene. Belladonna has struck again. But this time, she goes up against Glass Lass, created by Jimmy Owens, age 13, Wister, Oklahoma, and Mental Man, created by John Iverson, also age 13, from Sandia, Texas. Her poison darts bounce off Glass Lass, while a Mental Man projection of a dinosaur scares Belladonna into surrendering. And then as Detective King prepares to ask Mental Man and Glass Lass some probing questions, his son Christopher waves to him from across the parking lot, thanks to a projection by Mental Man. Of course, the end. So, Mr. Luke, your just overall big picture thoughts on this one.
You're right. It's a very short backup. I mean, I think this is about, what, eight, is it 10 pages at that? Yeah, 9 pages. We were right there in the middle. We were right around it. That being said, for it being a 9-page backup, there's a decent little story here. We do actually get the introduction of our villain. She has a motivation of sorts. She has a power set. We get three of the Dial H heroes, and we get a little bit of, you know, secret identity intrigue, and it's all in there in 9 pages. So I thought for a backup, it used its time pretty well.
Mm-hmm. I like that the kids weren't together the whole time. That was sort of a change of pace that I guess Chris is in the science class that went on the field trip and Vicky isn't. I mean, that happens in middle school sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I like that little bit of... I actually think they get some of the school stuff pretty well, although, again, they take some pretty wild field trips. A little suspension of disbelief there. And even though Vicky wasn't there at the time, she is the one that he turns to when he needs to recover. And again, their friendship has kind of ebbed and flowed over these issues, but they are partners, and that still holds. So again, a little bit of sort of low-level character continuity there, and a little bit of nuance. This did have the drawback, though, of only giving Vicky one chance to transform, because they're...
Right. The other thing that I thought was a little interesting is that for a book whose stars are school-age kids... This is very dark from a coloring and inking standpoint.
Okay.
I really like Trevor Van Eeden, and I'm a big fan of his work on... He did some Black Lightning and some other Bronze Age DC stuff. It's just that, like I said, the inking and everything is very heavy on a lot of this, and it serves to make the characters appear older than I think they're supposed to be.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting... Because also later on in this issue... Not to, you know, not to bury the lead here, but we do get a Hostess ad with the Penguin, and which is awesome. Shout out to loyal Earth Destruction Directive listener Jack Dower, who is a huge fan of the Penguin.
Yes.
But just compare the inking on the two pieces and you get an idea. I would have thought a book starring two school kids would have had a bit of a brighter palette overall. Even if they weren't, you know, even if Belladonna's not foiled by fruit pie.
I really like that little bit at the end where Chris manages, you know, to make himself and Mental Man, you know, both appear at the same time. Because again, you know, there's an obvious plot point. You know, your dad's a detective. No, you need to do something to throw him off the scent. Otherwise, mm-hmm. he's going to figure it out.
Yeah, and this being a DC comic, they do it in the tried and true DC Comics method of having an illusion of some kind or an artificial double or running really fast and changing clothes.
I'm pretty sure that was not Alfred dressed up as Chris, but it could have been. It could have been.
Yeah.
Now, which of these power sets was surprisingly close to one of your creations?
Actually, it was Mental Man, because the one thing that we see Mental Man is able to do is he projects the image of the monster into Belladonna's mind, even though it's not there. Mm-hmm. And then he does a similar thing, like you were saying, by making himself appear in front of his dad. The character that I developed for Mutants and Masterminds, she presented herself as like a summoner. She would take her sketchbook and she could draw a monster and summon mm-hmm. it to reality. But in fact, all she could do was create an illusion of the monster.
Ah, okay.
So the idea that he was created, so when he created a monster, and it was essentially an illusion, a mental illusion, instead of a magical one like my character was. That was the first thing I summoned back to, was my summoner.
Wasn't there an Ultraman episode where the kids' yes. monsters were coming to life?
Yes, that is Gavadon. Gavadon is a monster that was created by children's imagination and brought to life. And in fact, at the end of it, that episode, the captain, you know, they're suddenly very concerned because, well, there's no limit to what a child can imagine. They look at all the kids running and playing and all that, and they're like, oh, geez.
And which brings us back to the theme of Dial H, right? Children's
yeah.
imagination. So.
Imagination.
So we need to move on to the key part of our analysis, and we only had four reader creations here, but so not a lot of choices, not a lot to go on, but four are three categories here. Of these, what's your favorite name for a character?
My favorite name for a character is Moonlight. I think it's a cool name. It's a name I could buy. Like if you know, if you had told me, yeah, Moonlight, he was a member of the Teen Titans for a little bit in the mid-80s, I would have bought that. Tom Panarese is shaking his fist angrily at his MP3 player.
There would never have been a Moonlight. None of these are terrible. And
no.
I say that because we've had a few that have been. none of these were terrible. Now, of course, if this, you mentioned the Teen Titans. Of course, if this were the Legion of Superheroes, I mean, Glass Lass,
yeah.
Perfect,
I mean,
perfect candidate.
That writes itself. I mean, that's the Glass Lass, I have to admit, did make me chuckle.
Kind of like Belladonna as a name. That
yeah.
I mean, these are all pretty good, actually.
The thing I had, and I'm betraying, I think, my Marvel bias, because I believe it or not, it's very actually, I had a conversation with a friend of mine who only get to see her a couple of times a year. And she had said to me, well, you're more of a DC guy than a Marvel guy. And it got me thinking about it. It's like, you know, now a lot of times I would be classified that way now, you know, rapidly approaching middle age Luke, but I grew up reading Marvel. I didn't really read DC until I was in, you know, in high school, started reading The Flash during Wade and Augustine. Mm-hmm. So I grew up kind of more of a Marvel guy. So in my mind, Belladonna, that's Gambit's wife, isn't it?
Okay.
From the X-Men.
Gotcha. Okay.
So that was the first thing I thought. Now, I do like Belladonna's design. She's got, you know, just the body stocking with the skull belt that she borrowed from Mystique.
Big like sort of, yeah, vaguely a couple different shades of purple or violet. Redhead. I pretty fancy boots also, I'm just going to say.
Yeah.
That
yeah,
is Princess my favorite costume.
I do. The skull thing, I always like it, you know, because it makes me think of you may have been not the target demographic, but on Tiny Toon Adventure, Elmira wore the hairband with the skull on it.
So I'm thinking purple,
you know?
Purple and skull. I'm thinking the Phantom.
Or Evil-Lyn from Masters of the Universe also wore purple and had a skull headdress.
There you go. Yeah. Which of these which of the costume designs works for you most? For me it is Belladonna.
Yeah, I mean, I like Belladonna, but I really do like Moonlight, to be honest, from a costume design standpoint. When we first get a good look at him, on page two in the last panel when he's standing there and he announces his name. The first thing I thought of, are you familiar with the Golden Age version of the character Daredevil?
Oh, yeah.
Daredevil.
Sort of split down the middle.
Right. He was two-toned schemes, right. Like that. Yeah, so that was the first thing that popped into my mind. And then he's got the moon on his chest and the moon on his belt. And it reminded me of Eclipso. It's a really striking look just with the two-tone color like that. It's very simple, but it really stands out. And even with, I said, all the inking and everything, the heavy inks work really well.
Him, sure.
Yeah, because
half light, half dark.
Exactly. Like on page three, we got the two panels where he's shining, doing his light powers. Mm-hmm. And the black has both sides, but the black and the yellow have no detail whatsoever. They're just, you know, it's just like it's just this light or darkness. So I thought that was rather nice.
So if we were specifically ranking belt buckles, skull or crescent moon, I'm not saying for you specifically. I'm just saying in general.
The crescent moon fits moonlight, but the skull is classic.
Exactly.
And I
now we've already mentioned Mental Man. So is that your favorite power set?
I do like Mental Man's power set, but actually I was pretty impressed with Glasslass. What's interesting about Glasslass is that not only do the darts bounce off of her because she's got this, it's almost as like I think it was Grant Morrison gave Emma Frost her diamond skin.
Oh, right.
It's like, I'm going to use that Glasslass from that episode, that issue of Dial H. That's what I'm going to do. But then she holds it up and she can create like a solar beam by magnifying
right.
the light. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But what I like about Glasslass also, if you take a look at her costume is like if you crossed Wonder Woman's costume with Binary's costume when Carol Danvers was Binary in the Avengers and she had like that one piece thing covered up to her neck. She goes to the same hairstylist as like Starfire. She's got the really big hair in the back.
It was the 80s, Luke.
Then they both kind of combined to defeat her. I thought they were both well used here. Mm-hmm. The thing with Mental Man, though, that kind of struck me is, you know who he looks like to me? Do you remember the old X-Men character, the Mimic?
Okay.
From the Lee and Kirby days? Well, Mimic had the big glasses.
Right.
Kind of like Mental Man does. And I mean, Mental Man's got kind of a standard costume with the bodysuit and the trunks on the outside and the cape, and he's also got kind of a two-tone thing going on, which is interesting.
And with Google Glass, we're not that far away.
Except you only project it to yourself, stuff that's not there.
Well, we're getting there. A couple transformations, a little continuity, and he said backstory for the bad girl, and we defeat her.
Yeah. And as I said, it's not like Adventure for a while when it was like three features and everybody had 10 pages to work with. Here you had a lead story and then a backup. And for a backup story, this does exactly what I would ask of it to do in a Dial H backup. It gives us some new hero dials. It gives a little adventure and it you know shows off in this iteration of Dial H shows off some reader crew submissions.
Mm-hmm. That's all it's supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Any other comments on what we have here?
Just something that's a little timely. And maybe I'm reading too much into this, but Moonlight has powers of light and darkness. Mm-hmm. You think he's been watching that new Cloak and Dagger show?
Well, let's see. This is 1981. Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
Yeah, Cloak and Dagger were 82, mm-hmm. weren't they?
I think that Vincent Bruce is age 14. I'm sorry. Age of 40, as I think he's got a claim.
You got something, at least. Oh, and one other thing I did want to mention. Glasslass being essentially like a prism. If you were reading comics started when I was, you're very familiar with the DC event Bloodlines. Oh. All of the, you know, various and sundry heroes and villains introduced therein. And ironically, in the Eclipso annual that tied in to Bloodlines, the character that was introduced was named Prism. Her body was like a giant crystal, and she could do all sorts of crystalline type things. So again,
you're saying that Jimmy Owens of Wistar, Oklahoma, also has a claim.
Also has a claim, but the difference is that I don't think DC is developing a Prism TV show anytime soon. So Warner's may just let that one go. You know, probably about the same number of people remember Prism as remember Glass Lass.
I thought it was fun. I always like when there are more transformations. So I wish Vicky had gotten a second chance somehow, you know, or her own solo page. I like the fact that, you know, she was able to comfort Chris, but, you know, he got to be twice as heroic as she did.
Mm.
I'm just surprised by the little bits of continuity that are in here.
Mm.
And the bits of character development and the stuff with the dad and all of that, the secret identity stuff, all of that really surprised me. I was just simply expecting complete disconnected one-offs. And, you know, what we're getting story to story, issue to issue, is just a little bit more than that.
I think sometimes you can get that when you've got characters that aren't leaving their own title. I think it's easier right. to do that if you've got the same creative team month to month, or at least the same writer month to month. You can say, you know, little things like that that stick in your notebook, basically, as you're writing up scripts and pounding them out of the typewriter.
So if you had run across this book in the $5 for $1 bin that mm-hmm. you found at
yep.
Heroes Con, you, sir, my Heroes Con hero, would you have been intrigued by this one?
In the $5 for $1 bins, absolutely. Even maybe a bit more than that. I mean, this era of DC, I'm not super familiar with outside of like Hawkman and the Flash. The cover is very purple, but I like that it's thematically purple because it is in the dark room. So that would have,
right.
It would, it at least stands out. And I like that they tease the various heroes you might see inside. So yeah, I think definitely in the $5 for $1 bin, and maybe even up into the quarter bin.
Oh,
that I would have, this would have definitely been a pickup for sure.
Bold. Well, it is always great to talk to you, Luke.
And it's great to be on here, Professor. Like I said, as you alluded to, we had a great time at Heroes Con. Much capitalism, you know,
yes.
So money, but we're getting just an opportunity to talk about something that is a blind spot for me in my comics reading and collecting is always appreciated.
There you go. Now I'm sure listeners already know this, but if anyone wants to dial up your podcasts.
Hey.
Where would we go to do that?
My main podcast is Earth Destruction Directive, which is
yeah,
a Daikaiju podcast.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
And for those who are not familiar with the term, Daikaiju is Japanese for giant monster. So that show covers Godzilla, Gamera, Rodan, Gappa, King Ghidorah, all your favorite giant monsters, and probably some you're not as familiar with. And that can be found at the Two True Freaks Radio Network, which is twotruefreaks.com. I also am the co-host of The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror, which is a horror, primarily horror film, but all forms of horror podcast, also on Two True Freaks, which I co-host with my brother Jason and the Chris's, Chris Honeywell, and the hair metal hero Chris Tyler. And I also am the co-host of Get Back to the Wrestling, because finally there's a podcast on the internet about professional wrestling.
Now, technically, shouldn't that be Get Back to the Wrestling?
I'm the only one in South Carolina. The other guys are in New York and Massachusetts.
Okay. So up there, it is wrestling.
If we could get somebody from Mexico, because down there it's a real sport, but, you know. So Get Back to the Wrestling, which covers all aspects of professional wrestling, and that is also on twotruefreaks.com. So if you want to hear me, head on over to Two True Freaks, and you'll be sure to find one of my shows, and I'm hoping that one of them will appeal to the members of the audience of this show, who I know are of exquisite and very discriminating taste.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for joining me, buddy.
Oh, thank you for having me, Alan.
The Verdict on Action Comics 488. Those bits of continuity continue to give me enough to hang on to, and as we talked with Sean Ross, that first one especially had a large number of good creations. So I'm going with this one, definite quarter bin deal. Though if you can find it, in a $5 for $1 box. That's even a little bit better. That wraps up my coverage of Adventure Comics 488, bringing episode 121 of the Quarterbin Podcast to a close. Next time, on episode 122, we will again dial Q for Quarterbin. Two more guests will help me cover the very next issue, Adventure Comics 489, from DC, cover dated January 1982. And if all goes according to plan, that episode will have a little international flair. Again, thanks go out to my guests, Sean Ross from Marvel Secret Wars and Beyond and Welcome to Astro City, both part of the Pulp to Pixel podcast network, and Luke Giaconetti of Earth Destruction Directive and the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror, and other shows on the Two True Freaks Network for their important contributions to this episode. I wouldn't have done it without you guys. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or the podcast, dial H, or Sean, or Luke, feel free to contact me. I should say, feel free to dial F for feedback. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin. The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.
See, I was never much of a letter hack. Ironically, I think I've only ever written one email to a comic, and then it got printed. So I'm like batting 1,000. So I can't ever do it again, because then it's going to ruin my average.